Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Bob Vitalis, about to be Emeritus Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania and a recovering Middle East expert.
About to be and recovering are very seductive words. Can you elaborate a little bit about to be and especially recovering?
Sure. About to be is I took early retirement, negotiated early retirement after the kind of crisis broke out on the Penn campus. And my administration, as far as I could see, threw basically academic freedom, Palestinian students, Muslim students, you know, all of us under the bus in this desperate attempt, right, you know, to kind of prove their anti-Semitism positions and maybe salvage their positions. And it didn't work. And I literally did, you know, go to the dean and said, I can't teach Middle East politics anymore under the kind of new norms that you've set up. The only political work I've ever done historically has been in Palestinian activism. And that was in the 80s in Cambridge, Massachusetts, when I was still a graduate student. That said, I'm like a lot of old fart professors now, though unlike you, because you maintain your rock solid lefty credentials. I'm kind of like in part dismayed by what I've seen on campus this semester. Teaching Arab-Israeli conflict in the classroom, you know, I did it for the first time at Penn a year ago because the longtime specialist in Arab-Israeli conflict at Penn, Ian Lustig, God bless him, retired. He took the COVID option. And so I taught Arab-Israel for the first time. And that was very instructive to see where students were in, you know, on these questions. And I learned a bunch of things that I had not known. For instance, the controversy over the term indigenous. I thought that would be a straightforward, you know, thing to talk about. The controversy over settler colonial, which I also thought would be a straightforward thing to talk about. And then, you know, explaining, you know, in class, I remember this distinctly, the phrase from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, where that will come from. Well, all that was open, you know, discussion, a little fraught. I thought I handled it well in class. But under the new rules, it seemed to me that the university was establishing I was going to be subject to investigation if we even talk about these things. So, you know, I guess we'll get to the recovering part. This was not crucial to me at age 68, and I just turned 69, to continue to fight the good fight anymore in this context against this administration. And if I can just distract you for one more minute, what struck me was the great gap or that had emerged at Penn. I came to Penn in 1999. I was hired to run the Penn's Middle East Center and get back its Title VI monies. So you and Juan were talking about Title VI on your April 30th recording. Penn's Middle East Center had lost its funding. It was seen as a kind of sleepy place. They wanted a social scientist to come in and kind of sex it up, et cetera. So, and I was desperate to get closer to Princeton, where my then wife was teaching. So I took the job in a minute. And what I'm trying to get at is soon after that, right, 9/11 happens. And we had a president at the University of Pennsylvania at that point, Judith Rodin. Whatever else we think of her, she went on. I mean, she's a pretty famous president, went on to run the Rockefeller Foundation for a while. Well, Rodin, 2 days after 9/11, had a meeting of the entire campus in the largest single building on Penn's campus, Irvine Hall, holds about 900 people, but it was also broadcast remotely, and it was also broadcast on the local PBS radio station. And she invited five folks across political and ideological spectrum to talk to the campus about what happened, right? She didn't know me. And once she heard what I had to say, she kept me off the next round of her show, which she tried to bring on the road to attract donors. But what I'm trying to get at here is 2 days after a crisis event, the university embraced this idea that we need to be talking about this as a community. Penn in 2024, right? You know, October 7th happens, and it's like shut down, you know, and clamped down. And there has never been a space since October 7th where faculty could actually get together and talk about these matters. Since you care about the history of the left on universities. I spoke, you know, there were teach-ins soon after 9/11 during the Iraqi invasion. And I spoke at one with Ed Herman and other lefties. And again, you know, rooms of 250 people interested in these matters. Nothing like that has existed since October 7th at Penn and unfortunately at many other campuses around the United States. It's like shocking to me, basically. So the recovering part is who wants to deal with this Middle East stuff anymore? It's just, you know, between the endless wars and the kind of political, ideological battles that, for instance, Juan Cole seems to embrace and ran with and did incredible work, right, through informed comment. I was much more interested in actually pursuing, you know, kind of my intellectual interests and passions. And that took me in different directions, as we'll probably be talking about today, including the history of my own discipline or my own, you know, political science types in international relations. So it's been, you would probably appreciate this, but I think let me guess, you're going to ask me what's animating me and or retarding my, you know, existence at the present time. And what's animating me is the great learning curve that you get if you study something that you don't know anything about. So for me, what's exciting me these days is studying, going back and looking at the kind of struggles inside academia in the 1950s around the questions of China and Korea, which I've known nothing about. And I'm like reading like crazy. And it's like that gives me so much pleasure. And the only other thing that gives me more pleasure is actually working in people's archives. And so for the first time in a while, I've done trips to the Hoover Institution to work in the papers of conservative political scientists. And I just did another stint in papers in New Jersey. And I've loved working in archives since I first did it in 1988 without knowing what 1985 without knowing what I was getting into as a political scientist who didn't know anything about archives and then was seduced by them. So
just a couple of quick informational things, Bob, if I may. So you refer to Title VI, which is Title VI of the Federal Education Act in the U.S., and it's the one that really stimulates area studies and specifically language studies in universities. And so although it doesn't in itself bring a vast amount of money, it enables universities in the United States that apply and gain that funding to run courses in some languages that are pre-colonial and colonial and post-colonial, as well as some colonial languages in different parts of the world, including ones that are under threat, as well as stimulating more general area studies. And PBS is the public broadcasting system, which is not like the CBC in Canada or the BBC in Britain. It's really a fairly loose affiliation of television stations, some of them community-based in inverted commas, some based in universities, that put money into and get money from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and have some centralized programming, but often survive as a consequence of corporate underwriting of certain programs and also donations made by foundations, by individuals, by families, and so on. But on to these other points you mentioned, I wonder if we could pause for a moment on one of your more recent books. I'm particularly interested in the last couple, but the one that's about the history of the study of international relations, in which you point out that in the United States, which you take as the fons et origo rather than Britain, which is normally deemed to be the first home, that the systematic denial of the role of African American intellectuals began early and has continued and still continues. And I wondered if you could talk a bit about that book, perhaps with particular reference to people like W.E.B. Du Bois, whom you write about.
Sure. So I studied international relations as a graduate student at MIT, my first year, took the field seminar, as that's the way graduate, instruction is organized. But I had gone to MIT to study the Middle East. That was ostensibly my subject of expertise and who I first started to work with. And it would be on Egypt because as an undergraduate, I had the unique opportunity to be one of the first set of American students in the New York State University system to be given fellowships to go to Egypt after the United States reestablished its diplomatic relations in 1975. So I went in 1976, knew nothing about the Middle East, was studying political psychology of all things, because we've been talking about that a little bit, and experimental methods in political science. Went to the Middle East. It changed my life, unfortunately, as I see it now, because I actually stayed. After leaving Egypt, the 10 students who were invited to go, were also then invited to Israel for a 3-week all-paid tour by the World Zionist Organization, because here were Americans going to the Arab world for the first time. Half the group didn't want to go because they're already committed, pro-Arab, anti-Israeli kind of guys. I didn't care, and I went, and I ended up going to school in Haifa for the semester where I first studied about Palestinians and so forth. It was a very open environment. So, like I said, it changed my world. I went and applied to go to graduate school in Middle East politics. That said, in the field seminars, and it's still taught until roughly my book came out or the articles that first came out before the book. The basic argument runs like the field of international relations was founded in two places at the same time, the United States and Great Britain, after 1919, with the rise of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Royal Institute of International Affairs, sister organizations. And then the argument goes, and what the discipline of international relations was about in its early decades. Or what animated it was a debate between two theories of international organization, a kind of idealistic vision of world peace, possibility, world government, and so forth, versus a realpolitik, geopolitik, realism. And this was ostensibly the first debate in international relations. And then the story runs off from there. So we know, the factoid would be Foreign Affairs was the first journal of international relations in the United States. So I taught at the University of Texas for my first 3 years and then moved from the West, unfortunately, to the East for familial reasons, and started teaching at Clark University. Now, Clark is a kind of tiny research university. It famously was the country's second graduate school only institution, right? Johns Hopkins started as a graduate only program, and Clark started roughly at the same time as a graduate only program. Johns Hopkins to this day, is a visible, important place. The trustees at Clark, robbed its endowment very early on, and Clark went downhill. But the point about it was this really, really important place in the early 20th century. Okay, so I was in the archives. I was in the library at Clark. I remember this, my first semester teaching there. It was in December. You've probably had the same experience as I've had. You want to do anything but grade papers and exams. So I was messing around in the library, and I pulled a history out of about Clark, written by a geographer there. And geography is its one remaining important graduate department, actually. And there are a lot of great Marxist geographers there still. So I'm reading this history of Clark, and it says Clark University founded the first Journal of International Relations in the United States. It was called the Journal of Race Development. I said, what? You know, this is completely nuts. I have no idea what this means, et cetera. And I went and looked at the journal and went into the archives at Clark to take a look at this, where I learned that W.E.B. Du Bois was on the board of this journal, of the Journal of Race Development. And I was off and running. I said, you know, this upends. I was off and running except for one thing. I had no idea who W.E.B. Du Bois was, in the sense that, right, you know, from undergraduate days in the 70s through my graduate education in Middle East politics and international relations, I had never, ever encountered the name W.E.B. Du Bois. Right. So I start to explore who this guy is, and I see, you know, he's the genius of the 20th century. And how is it that, you know, that my whole undergraduate and graduate education could have gone through where I would not have encountered this name, particularly like in the realm of kind of international theory and global politics, if you will. So I was off and running and trying to figure out what this journal was. And that led me to the archives of many professors in many departments in many parts of the country, as I tried to piece together what I saw as the more credible story about the birth of international relations in the United States. And since I did that, there are folks who have kind of explored the same kinds of questions in, you will not be surprised to find out, the countries, Canada, Australia, South Africa, and England, right? Where we saw that really what was motivating the scholars at the time and what the institutions were at the time that were being set up to promote this new interdisciplinary study of international relations was what they all saw as the rising fear of race war as the outcome or as the consequence of the continuing imperialism, the late imperialism of the early mid 20th century. And, you know, that was as shocking, if you want, as finding Du Bois's name in all of this, because nothing like that was ever taught, you know, in the field. The field is usually about World War I, world government, you know, League of Nations, it kind of fails, World War II, New Realism, U.S. hegemony, we're off and running, though U.S. hegemony being a good thing, not a bad thing. I really spent 10 years in professors' papers. And then the second part of that discovery was, hey, there were these African Americans, and not just Du Bois. I consider them all, in a sense, not disciples, but followers and successors of Du Bois, who were literally in the, getting PhDs at places like Harvard, et cetera, right? Whether it's Ralph Bunche, or Alain Locke, this amazing guy, or Rayford Logan, or the first woman who got a PhD in international relations, first African-American woman, Merz Tate. These guys were all interested in international relations, in, to put it this way, inter-imperial relations, and challenging the racism that underpinned theories of international relations at the time. And, of course, none of them could teach in white institutions. And so they were all teaching at, you know, historically black colleges for the most part. Howard would have been the central part for this, like, kind of a cosmopolitan world politics, a focused set of intellectuals. And they've been completely written out of the discipline of international relations. No one knows these folks. Why would you ever read them? All those names I named for you are famous if you study Afro-America or Africana studies, right? Alain Locke, the history of the Harlem Renaissance and so forth, but never kind of encompassed as part of like the corpus of international relations theory. So that's roughly what consumed me for many years.
And it's a terrific book. I guess with Ralph Bunche, he is a figure, but not so much as a theorist, rather as an actor because of his administrative roles. But I guess part of what you're gesturing to is A, this notion of realism, which for listeners who are not part of international relations discourse, is basically a set of theories associated principally with E.H. Carr and Hans Morgenthau, who were one on the left, one more on the right, saying that what mattered in understanding international politics was that ultimately countries with the greatest economic and military clout would prevail in given disputes, right? I mean, that's roughly what that was. And I guess part of that became a nostrum within international relations, and I very much defer to your expertise, which was a bit like some areas of functionalist sociology. How can we retain an equilibrium? How do we stop conflicts breaking out that jeopardize the political economic interests of colonial powers or post-colonial powers? How do we keep, the pax understood as a peace that's in the interests of, Western European countries and the United States? That's how I pretty much understand the mission of the thing, at least when it, as it was, in a sense, given to me and others like me. Is that
I you that still holds until today, right?
does
I mean,
it? Does it?
well, the queerest thing ever about the social sciences, and it's particularly the social science of international relations, this discipline that for decades considered itself not a discipline but an interdiscipline, but now it's very much, housed in political science departments. The introductory classes for undergraduates, which are watered down versions of the graduate field seminars, right, for incoming students, learn there are three competing theories that animate the discipline. One is called, and one is always the winner. The first is realism. The second is known as, it comes under different names, but let's call it liberal internationalism. So all those characters these days who are still championing, the, what do they call it? The international liberal order, right? And that's under threat from China and Russia and Trump and the Marxist left, right? As they understand it, right? That's the second theory of international relations. And the third, well, there have been a multiple candidates over the course of time. So when I was an undergraduate and early graduate student, the third group, and you were part of this, I believe, as well, was something that they either call Marxism or dependency theory or structuralism, right? Well, guess what? Since about the 1980s, that's all disappeared from the radar screens of political science faculty and graduate students. And now there's an alternative third that's called constructivism, and that's where they also throw in feminism, post-colonialism, et cetera, right? And they're taught, in these, the three fields are taught. Now I want, let's stop and think about this for a second. If you were a science, this would be kind of crazy. Like if you were Chomsky studying and teaching generative grammar, right? You don't go, there's the left-wing school of linguistics, the liberal school of linguistics, and the right-wing school of linguistics, because it makes no sense. But that's how this heavily ideologized, discipline still constructs itself without even stopping to question this, that it just makes sense. And they still teach the undergraduates Thucydides, a Melian dialogue, where you supposedly learn the truths about power politics, and it's not changed since I've been an undergraduate, basically.
How was your book received, both by people in international relations and political science and more broadly?
Well, it's I'm sorry I'm stumbling because this makes me laugh so much. So I wrote two books before that book, one about the political economy of Egypt, and that came out that I was working on in the 80s and into the 90s, et cetera. But yeah, okay, it's a monograph. I didn't think it was going to matter to anyone. But the second book I worked on was a book about the U.S. role in Saudi Arabia. And I started to work on this round about the time of the 1990 war. Basically, that's when I was trying to raise first money. So Kuwait's there. The United States is just occupied, if I can say that, Saudi Arabia, with its massive troops, et cetera. Continued to work on it through 9/11, and it came out in 2005. I said, this book has got to be the big book, because what it tries to show is that whatever the story is, stories are that America tells about itself, in its, you know, beneficence and the way it was different from Britain in the Gulf, et cetera. I demonstrate that the Americans go to Saudi Arabia and they construct this Jim Crow system of, of oppression in the Saudi oil fields. And they do that because they want to do it, not because the Saudis make them. And I show that the Saudis really have no role to play, the Saudi leadership in Saudi Arabia, in the oil fields. They just want the money from it. And here are the Americans are kind of setting up this role, you know, a system of racist pay scales and so on. And I demonstrate that this is the story of mining firms across the 19th century. And the United States just brings it to Saudi Arabia. I thought, shit, this book is going to be the big book. Verso picked it up. Tariq Ali reviewed it. So God bless them, et cetera. I write this book about the professors of international relations that I think only international, that is going to be so boring to the world. It's the book that by far has sold the most. I continue to get, royalty checks from it. Yeah, not going to retire on that money, but, $500, $600, $700 a year on that book. I won a theory prize, though I don't consider myself a theorist. Et cetera. So for sure, it has had the most impact. It's the one that's most cited, et cetera. And I finally decided that's because professors want to read about themselves. I mean, I don't know how else to think about it. The book was received really well. You will barely find a negative review of it, save in Foreign Affairs, of course, where they proclaim this is kind of interesting. I forgot to tell the listeners a key fact. The Journal of Race Development, which was really a journal of, let's say, liberal racism, right? That races can develop. It's the matter. It's kind of the journal of uplift. It's the journal of how to think about Tuskegee, but in an international context. And it really does read like an early foreign affairs journal, because there'll also be stories about Finland, right? Anything but the United States, save when you're dealing with benighted races in the United States, which then you could study. So this Journal of Race Development changes its name to the Journal of International Relations at Clark in 1918, et cetera. Now, I told you Clark was running into money problems by 1920 and 21. Well, one of the things the trustees do is sell the journal to this new organization that's just been founded called the Council on Foreign Relations. And that they were a sleepy group as far as I'm considered. But, East Coast elites galvanized by the First World War in the hopes to continue kind of, international conciliation and transatlantic relations, think they need a journal. And they decide this country will not be able to actually afford two journals. No journal is going to succeed. So they buy Clark's Journal of International Relations. They rename it the Quarterly Journal of Foreign Affairs. And they go, no, that's too sleepy too. Let's just call it Foreign Affairs. And the first editors and book reviewers are all the folks from the Journal of Race Development and the Journal of International Relations. So there's this really, close tie there. And famously, Du Bois published many times in the 1920s in Foreign Affairs. And then, of course, as he turns more lefty, because by 1930s, Du Bois is arguing for what? Basically, he's a separate state. He becomes a black nationalist in the 30s advocating a black self-help as the only solution for the problems of Afro-America. And as you know, by the 1940s and 50s, he signed on as a communist, etc. He never appear, of course, he never appears in foreign affairs again. I forgot where I was going with this, which also happens to me.
No, we were talking about...
Say that again?
We were talking about the reception that the book got.
Right. So foreign affairs said... That's the connection. I even got a review by the editor of Foreign Affairs, which is rare. Typically, it's those little paragraph ones. And he said, this, you know, Vitalis has offered up these kind of interesting hypotheses. He surely, you know, has done remarkable archival work. It's absurd to think that racism still matters to American international relations at the present time, right? You know, we can beg to differ. Juan, you know, in his podcast interview with you, you know, ran with that last part of the book and says that's why it really matters. Vitalis says you still see the kind of echoes or shadows or worse of this earlier moment in foreign affairsizing, you know, of the day. And I, you know, do think that's right, but I didn't explore that in the book, etc. But I want to tell you, so the reviews were great. What I've never experienced before or since is the tremendous efforts to stop me from doing this work by the professors. I have never encountered this before, but, you know, I applied for a retraining grant in African American studies as a way of kind of getting myself up to speed. And the head of the committee that was in charge of funding, you know, basically put obstacle after obstacle in the way of the funding committee from awarding me a grant, which folks wanted them to do, etc. So he opposed this tremendously, and I kind of documented a little bit. I was kind of shocked by it all. I got a booby prize of one of the 2 years of funding because the fights caused basically the breakdown of the entire committee. This was a joint committee of the Social Science Research Council and the MacArthur Foundation. And they stopped work because they were just fighting about my proposal to do this book. So, you know, interesting data point. I also tried to raise money from the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C., learned that, no, they can't fund my book. Sorry. I get contacted by one of the trustees. I have an African-American guy. I have fought tremendously to get you money for this book. And they finally heeded my opposition. And they're giving you a booby prize of, you know, a half year as opposed to a full year. So something about, right, this combination, two arguments, that imperialism and racism is what animated the discipline from the start. And African Americans were theorists African Americans were theorizing, in fact, ways that we've come to embrace, and yet they've been written out of the discipline. So, you know, one or both of those arguments have really rubbed, you know, scholars raw, basically. And at the very end of the very tail end of this process, we could maybe talk about this strategy for other academics. I sent it out to multiple presses at once because I've determined that, you know, presses are like businesses. They're not like journals, though I do think peer review is a broken down system. But, you know, I would multiply submit this book. And when I was negotiating with folks, UCal Press sent it out to some extra reviewers. And one of them was the field's most important political scientist in international relations. May he rest in peace, Bob Jervis. Now, people love this guy who's at Columbia. I'm sure he's a very, very kind man. He desperately tried to stop the publication of this book, said Vitalis has some ideas here, but none of them are really proven, and he should start again. You know, and kind of and I have his review to this day, and it was the only, right? So the disciplinary insider was the only guy who actively tried to quash the book from being published. But, you know, I just went with a different press. And so, I have 14 positive reviews and one negative one by the peer-ish review process at presses.
One thing that I'd like to jump in with there for listeners who may not be familiar with foreign affairs, this journal is not like a standard academic journal in the sense that it has full-page color glossy advertising on behalf of major corporations. It is written in by major political leaders. It has very few, if any, footnotes, and the material that it publishes is very, very important in terms of debates about realpolitik. And the Council on Foreign Relations probably leans in the direction of the Clintons in terms of foreign policy and Obama more than the Republican Party, or certainly more than the current Republican Party. It would be
But
on
definitely
the
more than the current.
Yeah, it would be more on the side of liberal internationalism, as you say, though it was founded as a bipartisan entity. So it's important to realize that what Prof. Vitalis is telling us is not just a sort of devastatingly intramural, narcissistic scholarly world. We're talking about a domain that was founded on not so much the ashes, but the burning flames of imperialism
Yeah.
and colonialism. And one of the things that people who are part of that world, and it applies to the journal Foreign Policy as well, is that they are not just scholars. These guys and gals sit around the table with decision makers and frequently, and I'm thinking here mostly of the United States, move into administrations of presidents and are purposive actors. So this is not, some sort of arcane discussion. These people have real-world effects in ways that we don't often associate with
Right. The question
such activity.
becomes these, scholars, I would call them scholar practitioners, more
Yes.
practitioners than scholars, or scholars who are, opting to try to affect public policy, right? And the main debate in that realm, which enters into the kind of world that you care about, communications and culture, is the question of those folks who are trying to influence the public debates. Do they actually shape what policymakers do? That's one argument. And of course, the intellectuals always want to believe it's their ideas that matter. Or are those ideas being selected because they do what it is that the politicians or statespeople, already want? Are they ventriloquizing, positions? But for sure, it's key. It's been key in every decade of American foreign policy that if you could produce a or an argument or an article that grabs the headlines and grabs people's attentions, right, from George Kennan's X telegram in the 1940s to you guys were talking about Sam Huntington and the clash of civilizations, right, whenever that was in the 1990s, to the arguments today about why in so-called engagers in China have lost and why the United States now needs to strategically compete with China, right? That's where those debate, that's where the public looks for, or the public grabs onto ideas, not in the, needless to say, as the scholarly journals that, six people read the article and so forth.
Now that leads me towards your, I think, latest book or the latest of yours that I've read, Oilcraft. And
Yeah.
one of the things about this, it's part of a group of works that to me expose the United States and Western Europe as petro states, which they have long been, but which they claim not to be. But one of the points of skepticism that animates that book, as I interpret it, relates to what you just said. Intellectuals and people reading the thoughts of intellectuals want to believe that the words that they say and politicians say should be read denotatively, that they can be read almost literally. And in fact, I guess part of what you're saying is you need to look at what the real political economic circumstances are rather than the rhetoric. So you're very skeptical about the idea of an OPEC-caused oil crisis in the 70s. You're very skeptical about the idea that the US relies on relations with Saudi. You point out that these things are spurious. And of course, they've become even more dubious since guess what is the world's number one exporter of oil? United States.
Yay!
USA! Go team!
Except Biden has ruined it, according to Trump, because it's Trump. Everything was good. The prices were down, et cetera. Poor Biden, who has been like pumping, organizing subsidies to pump more oil than ever before, right? Nonetheless, is targeted as like a guy who's, what's called, handcuffed the industry. But yes, USA, big exporter these days.
So could you take us through the oil craft arguments? Because it's a complex book, it's a complex set of arguments, and I'm aware that I haven't really
Well,
done justice to the whole thing.
I don't know that it's a complex set of arguments. But the basic argument is what we believe about the need, right, to secure oil, and hence that need as the ore structure, of international relations in the 20th century is wrong. And the book tries to work through why that's wrong. First, it reminds us of something. It's actually my favorite part of the book, but it's the part that, here, I have a fight with Rick Perlstein. I don't know if you know who he is, but he self-defines as America's public historian of conservatism in the United States. He's written a series of books about Goldwater, Reagan, Nixon, and he's this tremendous historian and storyteller, and his books are all 600 pages. He's a good lefty. He has galvanized the field of the history of conservatism, and since I'm interested in that now, I've been reading him like crazy. But when I when he, the part of the book I like the best is the part he said, "Get rid of, you don't need this thing." I go back to the 1920s in that book and uncover a set of progressive historians at Columbia who at that moment challenge the common wisdom of the day. And I want to be careful about what that common wisdom of the day was in the 1920s, that Western powers were needed to secure, right, exclusive access or guaranteed access to resources, natural resources of all kinds. Now, you will remember this, right, Toby, because you were a dependista of some sort as well. And we were still in the days of the 60s and 70s where we were talking about copper in Chile, right, and iron and cotton in Egypt, right? And these guys in the 20s are kind of going, so if you think about it, our ideas about imperialism derive from that moment of the 20s when folks are arguing about, nationalism is rising in these various places. Colonial possessions are sources of raw materials, and to be great, we have to preserve this access to our raw materials. So the fight was about raw materials of all kinds, and rubber would have been one of the key ones. Okay. And these professors at Columbia in the 20s kind of look askance at these ideas and explore them, and argue that they make no sense, and they develop a set of arguments about why they make no sense. And so I in those arguments are the last time, I guess I would put it this way, in the 20s is the last time in early 30s that their kind of skepticism was the core of a kind of left-wing thought, or progressive thought. Because in the 40s and 50s, right, we have this scare about raw materials of all sorts. It's this moment like anti-communism fear, McCarthyism, the 50s. America is producing all these hearings and investigations to see how are we going to secure all our strategic minerals, right? Uranium and copper and so forth. And it's crazy from the 50s and 60s. And from that moment on, the left has seized upon those facts in the archives to say, see, this is the core of what Western imperialism is, right? And that would lead you, and I'm sure you remember this, books in the 60s and 70s by young new critics like Noam Chomsky that explain the reason the United States is in Vietnam is to secure its raw materials, tungsten for its airplanes and so forth, right? So it's all about raw materials, raw materials, raw materials. The left grabs onto that. OPEC happens. The 70s happens. And since that moment, right, we've stopped talking about raw materials of all sorts, though they're coming back, right, at the latest moment. And that vision on the left and the right about, on the right, we need to secure all these raw materials of all kinds. On the left, aha, you know, this is imperialism, and we have to undermine that system by either, you know, independent development or, you know, going green, et cetera, has turned into the story just about oil. So I'm really interested in that transformation where all that fear of raw materials, you know, gets embodied into the story about one raw material in particular, oil. So as you probably know, from the 1990s, the first Gulf War, the United States and Kuwait, that's when Daniel Yergin produces his book, The Prize. It's 700 pages, right? And its argument is the whole history of the 20th century is to be understood as a struggle for oil, as a source of wealth and power. So this was very interesting to me, because that's not how folks in the 20s, 30s, and 40s understood the 20s, 30s, and 40s. It's how folks in the 90s have rewritten the history of that earlier moment to make it seem as if oil is the only thing that really matters. And my argument is the progressives in the 20s were right. You don't really need to do anything to secure this resource, right? During peacetime, you buy it. And during wartime, you have no guarantees of access to these resources anyway, for a variety of reasons. And so the whole, and then, you know, kind of the inflation of threats of all sorts. You'll remember from 1980, this idea that the Russians were coming right from the Soviet Union. They had just occupied Afghanistan. What's their target? The Persian Gulf, and they're going to take the oil. And we get the Carter Doctrine. We get the U.S. footprint in the Middle East for the first time, right? The militarization of direct boots on the ground, first time. Well, where did all these ideas come from, and why? So, you know, policymakers articulate this idea. The thing about my book is I decided I don't know what policymakers actually think, okay? Because they could be telling the truth, or if you're Noam Chomsky, right, they're never telling the truth, save in the archival records, right, where it's written down, there the policymakers are thinking, but, you know, at large he talks about, right, strategic rationales and stuff. Well, I believe, though, that scholars are telling the truth, and I'm really caught up with this idea that scholars on the left and right believe there's some real logic to controlling the oil, or the need to control the oil, or that's the way the left sees it, control it, it's the big oil companies. The right and the liberals kind of see the need to guarantee secure access to oil. And I just don't get it, because you just buy it on the world market, and there's been no global war since 1940 where the scarcity fears during wartime, right, preoccupied the planners. But since that time, you know, we've had no problem. And in fact, I guess the thing about OPEC and the crisis of the 70s is, you know, the standard argument is to say something like this: a market has been taken over by this collusive brand of ex-third world countries that, you know, control the market. Well, no, actually what has happened is OPEC permitted the creation of a real world market in oil. And folks don't understand that, right? I don't know if you're a futures trader or a day trader, but you could go trade oil now, right? Oil futures. That had existed for most of the 20th century. And it's what OPEC's kind of price revolution One of the effects of that price revolution has been to transform the nature of the world oil market. So I kind of don't believe we need to do any of this stuff. I don't know what politicians are really thinking, though I think folks are exaggerating the threats all along. And I think the left would be better off if they recognized that their ideas about what all this means makes no sense.
And one of the instances you give in the book of the irrationality of rationality is explanations for the US and lapdog invasion of Iraq in 2003, where lots of people on the left were saying this is all about oil. Rupert Murdoch said it was about oil and got all his newspapers around the world to support it for that reason. But in fact, there's no evidence that that was really what was going on. And you can see all sorts of other madnesses in the stupidity of the Bush camp, the Blair camp, and their lunatic advisors, none of whom had any expertise in the region. They couldn't speak the languages. They hadn't spent time there. And they were caught up in a kind of Michael Waltzer fantasy of a just war, albeit in this case, not one where they had been attacked. And in what it seems to me is an animating force of US foreign policy at the level of military intervention, liberal internationalism, which is to say, which the British say all the time, whatever you bastards think of us, we did one good thing. We beat the fucking fascists in 1945, and that is our license to do what we bloody well please, including a parthenogenetic remodeling of the world. And that is also Russia's legitimation for its imperial enterprises. Whatever you bastards think, we did one good thing. We beat the fucking fascists. And by the way, 25 million Soviets lost their lives doing it, a few more than in the case of Britain, the United States, France, and any other country you care to name. So it seems to me that there is that element that's real, which is this fantasy about constructing other countries which are picked on for whatever reason in one's own imaginary image. But that's not necessarily anything to do with oil. And I think you make the argument very persuasively in the book.
Well, you know, Saddam, you know, some right-wing economists, I think, were onto something smart. But I can't say again, it's them applying their own thinking, right, to the situation they're seeing that makes no sense for them rationally and trying to come up with a rational explanation. In their arguments, the right wingers were sort of saying it's not about oil. They started saying this in 1990. It's not about oil as a commodity, right, which you can just buy. It's about the oil wealth, the rents, in the hands of people we don't like, because they're going to use that wealth, right, to, you know, continue their counter-hegemonic project. So if anything drove folks crazy about, should have been driving people crazy about Saddam Hussein, is what he was doing with his oil wealth, right, which was generally, you know, challenging to some extent American hegemonic ambitions, but certainly also, you know, willing, as we've seen at moments, right, to go along with the great, you know, with the great powers, et cetera. So that, you know, I think oil rents go a lot farther to helping us make sense of what we've seen across the last part of the 20th and into the 21st century than the oil itself. But that doesn't stop people from still holding on to that, you know, idea that it's oil. And then, of course, for the left, and I was having this fight in those teach-ins in 2003 with people like Ed Herman, you know, who would simply say, these are the major American oil companies trying to get the oil in, you know, Iraq, et cetera. And as you said, there's absolutely no evidence for that whatsoever. And Iraq would have liked nothing more than to be able to sell oil on the world market, which it was being prevented from doing, right? So as I say in the book, if what we really cared about was oil scarcity or the price of oil, you lift the sanctions and let the Iraqis do their thing. And you let Western firms in or firms of some sort to come in and renovate the fields, et cetera, which is kind of what's happened now, right? But the fact is that Saddam would have been just as happy doing it as well. So it's something other than oil, if we want to believe that policymakers are equally rational, know the truth, and are just misleading folks. Because, you know, they all talk about oil scarcity. Obama talked about it, et cetera. And I think these are just these deeply held, you know, fears or beliefs that are virtually not. It's not like I'm going to change anybody's minds. And the I'll call it the oil myths still exist and are out there, and they're going to be continue to be talked about the very next time there's a price rise. You notice no one's talking about oil right now because it's all, you remember, but in Ukraine, Russia, there's going to be this crisis, et cetera. Well, what happened? You know, we ended up buying oil on the world market and the United States exports more, et cetera. So anyway, you get the point.
Prof. Vitalis, I've got one more question for you, and then I'd like to throw things to you, if I may, to conclude, inviting you either to go back over what we've said and add something, or to introduce some new material. Does that sound okay as a way of bringing things to a conclusion?
Sure.
So my last question is to ask you how you know stuff. You've told us about use of the archives, but that came relatively late in your scholarly career. So what's your repertoire of methods for finding stuff out?
You know, I don't want to say I was a born revisionist. I was seduced by revisionist histories of the Cold War, right? Late in my undergraduate career. So, you know, first of all, I was like a uninformed lefty in high school, as we, you know, as many people were in my age, you know, the time of the moratorium. I wasn't old enough to go to Washington, but participated in the peace moratoriums, embraced the kind of critics of the Vietnam War, learned the idea of imperialism for the first time. These views, needless to say, were all reinforced by spending a year in Cairo, in Egypt, and in Israel, where, you know, this discourse about imperialism, about class, etc., was everywhere. And I came back and fell into line with a set of the left wing of the area studies movement. So Juan Cole describes himself that same way, right, in your interview with him, where he's talking about going to American University in Beirut in the 70s, meeting with these figures, working with Nikki Keddy. He would have been an early leftist rethinker of area studies. And I stumbled into that moment or world. I didn't really have much in the way of method. I read books. I deployed a kind of revisionist cast to things. But it's really when I started, you know, very right before I was supposed to go off to Egypt to do the field work for my dissertation, which I thought was going to be about construction companies. You would appreciate this because in the era of dependency theory and then Peter Evans's revision of dependency theories in his book, Dependent Development, he noticed something, right, in this account of Brazil opening up during its abertura, right, which was this opening to foreign capital. Well, Egypt had the same thing. It was called the infatah, the opening up to foreign capital. But one of the lines in Peter's book is, you know, not all sectors of the political economy come to be taken over by multinational capital in the same way. And one of the most interesting areas was construction. And he says this in the book. And I said, you know, that's where the new class of entrepreneurs in Egypt were happening in the 70s was in the construction sector. So I thought I was going to study the new construction magnate, big capitalists, et cetera. Right before leaving for Egypt, a professor at MIT at the time. He then got me hired at Texas. This is Tom Ferguson, kind of left-wing structuralist critic of the American political economy. He's now retired, but he works for the Roosevelt Institute, and he's still doing strong. You know, his whole thing is, His whole thing is investors control everything about American politics. The you know, so you just have to look at the investor coalitions and figure out who's running the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, who's funding Trump, who's funding any election. And he did a series of books, The Hidden Election, and so forth. That's his thing. He's super smart about it. Tom said to me soon before I was going off, I just remember this one thing. He kind of snorts. So he goes, you got to get the docs on these pigs, right? And so you got to get the documents on these pigs. And I'm trying to, like, it's like the Buddha has told me something. What can that possibly mean? So I go into archives, both in Cambridge, Massachusetts, because I could work in the business school for a little while. But then right before leaving for Egypt, I go to the State Department records. And I'm reading them, looking at the Egypt records. And I'm seeing this world open up that contradicts, undermines everything I've learned from the books by critical political economy of the time and by the dependency theorists of the time about, and you'll appreciate this argument from that moment. There were two kinds of capitalists in these local political economies, national capital, which were, you know, had the nation, you know, at heart and was trying to develop and modern and industrialize, and that was going to make their country great. And then comprador capitalists, and the compradors were the folks, you know, who were the handmaidens of the Western imperial powers. Well, I'm reading the documents about what the guy who was described as Egypt's chief comprador, and everything I'm reading is undermining the beliefs about that guy. So I stopped. I said, wait, what is this? And I decide I'm not going to write about the 1970s. I'm going to write about the 20s and 30s because this window has opened up to me from the archival records in the part of the archives that people don't use, right? So diplomatic historians always want to see, you know, what were the politicians doing with the other politicians? Who's organizing the coup? But there's this vast material on like the economies of these semi-industrialized, right, semi-colonialized countries. So it just changed what I did, and it was archives from then on. So I hate, you know, so it's a combination of knowing what's been said, right, and looking for ways where that has, you know, where that can be challenged. Yeah, and you know that, you know, so basically every one of my books is about exploding a variety of myths that kind of emerge, you know, in the discourses of a particular sector, discipline, industry, national, you know, and national histories.
Now, I think that Peter Evans' book is a landmark, as you say, and Bill Warren before his early passing. And
God bless him.
Right. And so many people who worked out, Dick Robison in Indonesia. My God, these local bourgeoisies are...
I love that book too.
They're not supposed to.
I love that book about Indonesia.
They're not supposed to be forming what's going on. So, Prof, to conclude matters, I'd like to turn things over to you now to add anything, as I said, to what you've already discussed or to bring in new material.
Well, there's a couple of things. Really quickly, that work that you're describing, that moment, the dependency moment, dependent development moment, the criticisms of dependency, they need to be brought back and read again, as opposed to be thinking of, right? You know, if you're a graduate student these days, you know that kind of happened. You know, you get a potted version of it, but you don't read those books. The reasons why I care is I wrote a critique of a book that is by far the big book in like left imperial social theory. Everyone loves this book. It's called World Making After Empire by Adam Gedichew. And, you know, her argument is, I call it a romance, but everyone else thinks it's like the latest word. Basically how folks like Kwame Nkrumah, you know, had to seize self-determination as a right and then attempted to construct federations that it's never explained how, in some way would undermine the Western imperial system. So say if, you know, six or seven or eight African countries successfully federated, right, we'd be in a different world. How after that, Kwame Nkrumah's followers or people like Jacob Manley, and it's a very truncated cast in this book of basically Afro-Americans and Afro-Caribbeans, sought the new international economic order. When that failed, we got open and unbridled imperialism, and it's the world we live in today. And America is more powerful than it ever has been, and you know, the rest of the world is you know, suffering under it. And in that account, all those arguments about, you know, the problems with dependency theory, or here, Kwame Nkrumah, right? The neocolonialism, the highest stage of capitalism, or the last stage of imperialism. I can't remember the exact title, right? Let us leave aside that in one of my works, I discovered that Kwame Nkrumah's book, Africa Must Unite, was ghostwritten by an Israeli, right? Because this is when Kwame Nkrumah had great relations with the Israelis. Now, you don't want to really be talking about that moment because he's the great, you know, great theorist of neocolonialism. And in my review, I uncovered, you know, the set of political scientists at the time who originally embraced Nkrumah and then saw what a disaster this was. Emmanuel Wallerstein being one of them, Crawford Young, who goes on to become a great, you know, the country's, the United States' leading Africanist for a generation, Martin Kilson and others who were challenging then these, like, the romance of Pan-Africanism at the time, and showing that the political, in political economic terms, the arguments were a problem. So for Kwame Nkrumah, it turns out, he, you know, you would not be surprised by this. He was getting rich himself, and, you know, the cronies around him were getting rich because they're willing and dealing with the multinationals. But that doesn't fit the story they want to tell about, you know, kind of a neocolonialism. So in the 2010s and 2020s, we have this, like, kind of miscast of the past, right? In this romance about the third world, again, and what thwarted the new international economic order, not the divisions among them, not that, for instance, Kwame Nkrumah himself. Well, one of the things I discovered was, you know, though people think Egypt and Kwame Nkrumah were really close, Kwame Nkrumah's closest allies were advising him that Egypt was seeking to take over Ghana. So I don't know if you know this, but Kwame Nkrumah married an Egyptian woman who he could not communicate with. And that was part of a press. She was a Copt, right? But she spoke Arabic. That was part of this complex, like, kind of, you know, what do you want to, you know, power politics in parts of the third world in the 50s and 60s. And none of that is, like, written about these days. And instead, it's just this, you know, I don't know how else to describe it. This place that sought to undermine imperialism has failed, and we live in the world we live in today. Luckily, there are voices who complicate things like that. Pankaj Mishra, for instance, Adam Schatz, who complicates the stories about Fanon and so forth. So how's that?
That's fantastic. Thank you. And for those who don't know, Kwame Nkrumah was the, I guess, first president of Ghana. And Ghana was really the beginning of what the British called the winds of change, Prime Minister Harold Macmillan's phrase, which was accepting the need to decolonize most of what it had, particularly in Eastern and Western Africa, but also in the Caribbean, and to do so in part because it was instructed to do that by the United States in terms of opening up markets, but also in terms of the fact that what had been in the days of the slave trade really important resources of labor for the emerging industrial economy in Britain had turned into costs, and particularly so in the post-war period when the US and others, but especially the United States, had Britain in so much debt. And so the decolonization period emerges in part, yes, because of important nationalist movements of resistance, some of them supported by the Soviet Union, some not, but also because of self-interest on the part of the British, recognizing that the game was So thanks very much, Prof. Greatly appreciated. It was
Great
terrific
talking to you.
getting to chat to you. Good luck with your recovery.
Thanks. Be good, Toby.
Okay, happy
Good night.
days.
Yep.